Church of the Brethren webcast series. I am Anton Eller, executive producer of these webcasts, and your host for this program. Welcome, everyone, to the ninth and next to final podcast in the series about the Chronicler. With me today is Stephen Schweitzer. Steve is the academic dean at Bethany Theological Seminary and has been part of the faculty since the fall of 2009. Prior to that time, Steve served as assistant professor of Old Testament at the Associated Mennonite Biblical Seminary. Steve obtained his Master of Arts in Theology from the University of St. Thomas, and then his PhD in Theology from the University of Notre Dame. While Steve was writing his dissertation at Notre Dame, he focused on Chronicles, and his dissertation has since been published as Reading Utopia in Chronicles. So welcome, Steve, to share with us these insights about the rest of the story of Chronicles.
Thanks, Anton. And again, thanks for this time to talk about a book that I deeply love and am passionate about. And again, thanks to the Brethren Academy for making this possible. This discussion we're going to have right now is tied to Chapter 9 in the book, The Rest of the Story, which essentially picks up after Solomon and gives you a very quick glance through about 25 chapters of text in a pretty quick way. So I'm not going to try to hit all of the highlights of that, but point out a few things that I think are particularly worth noting and probe a couple issues, mostly focusing on Hezekiah in 2 Chronicles chapter 30, but beginning a little bit earlier than that. So this is by no means exhaustive, but it's just meant to point out a couple things that are in the rest of the story of Chronicles after Solomon. So 2 Chronicles 11 and 12 focus on Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, and most students of the Bible are familiar with Rehoboam's stupid decision to follow the younger men around him and the result of that in splitting up the kingdom. What's interesting in the chronicler's account is that in Shishak's invasion following this in chapter 12, the chronicler states that in spite of, or maybe even as a result of, this invasion by Shishak and the plundering of the temple, in verse 12 of chapter 12, the narrator says, "Moreover, conditions were good in Judah." So in the midst of this devastation, the chronicler says that all things were tov, that they were good. It's not what you would expect to find in this text. You would expect to find some statement of, boy, this can't get much worse, can it? But that's not what the text says. And so when I first started working on how this text functioned, I was immediately struck by the seeming incongruity of this statement. Here we see that a foreign power, Egypt, has essentially taken control of Israel briefly and plundered them and subjugated its people, however briefly. This suggests to me that the chronicler is much less concerned about political systems than he is about other things like the worship of God or the conditions of the people in the land. The chronicler has no issues with a foreign power controlling the land of Israel. He does not call for open revolt against any of these kingdoms, whether it's Egypt or Babylon or Persia. Instead, the chronicler continually recognizes that God uses foreign powers as instruments in God's will. So here's an example of Shishak being one of them, and particularly here that things are still good in Judah, that this is not a problem, there should not be despair. And so rather than engaging in an armed revolt and kicking the Egyptians out, there's no suggestion of that whatsoever here in the text. So we see a similar thing then with the Babylonians, where God uses them. We see a similar thing with Pharaoh Necho in Josiah's death. In chapter 35, when Josiah dies, Pharaoh Necho tries to tell Josiah not to come because he's on a mission from God, which is pretty much what it says in the text. And then Josiah refuses to listen to that and goes out to battle him anyway. And then the chronicler says, the narrator, again, not Josiah, not Necho, says that Josiah died because he did not listen to the voice of Necho from the mouth of God. And so the chronicler clearly understands that Necho had been speaking the truth, that he was an emissary of God in some way. And so Josiah was wrong to get in his way and died as a result because he did not listen to God's voice in the mouth of a foreign king. Then we get to the end of the book with Cyrus, who issues the edict, allowing the people to return from the land. And there we see that the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus. So it's God who's responsible for this, and that this fulfills the word of Jeremiah the prophet. So we see that God can speak through a foreign king, God can use a foreign king, and that in no case does the chronicler suggest the response should be open revolt against these foreign powers, but rather, perhaps this is what God has for us at this time. And so back in the first podcast, I talked about how this was a time of great upheaval. There's apocalyptic visions out there. People might be suggesting revolt. The chronicler wants nothing to do with that. There is not a call for armed resistance to these foreign powers, but instead a recognition that God might actually be using them in the present for God's purpose. So that's a very different view than what we get in a good chunk of the Old Testament that would like to throw these guys out. And certainly at the time of Jesus, the desire by many people to kick the Romans out, and we're waiting for Jesus just to step in and get rid of Rome, that's not the view you get in Chronicles. The chronicler is not that concerned about who's in charge politically, because God is really in charge.
It strikes me that when Jesus was here, a lot of people didn't understand him because he didn't seem that concerned about kicking the Romans out.
Exactly. And it, in many ways, Jesus' failure to act politically certainly contributed to the people turning against him. Mm. And eventually, of course, resulted in his death. Another example from this rest of the story, in Jehoshaphat's narrative in 2 Chronicles 20, we see a famous battle scene that's really a non-battle, in which Jehoshaphat and the people of Israel are being attacked by a coalition of forces, and they are greatly outnumbered, and Jehoshaphat calls for a time of fasting. It's one of the two places in Chronicles where a fast is proclaimed. And here we have this moment of fasting, and as a result, in the midst of this outpouring of prayer to God, the Lord sends God's Spirit on a Levite named Jahaziel to prophesy to the people. And this is starting around in verse 15, where Jahaziel speaks encouragingly to the people not to be afraid, and that that God will be with you, and to go out. And in verse 17, the battle is not for you to fight. Take your position, stand still, and see the victory of the Lord on your behalf, O Judah and Jerusalem. This echoes the words, of course, from Exodus, where Moses tells the people to stand still and see the salvation of your God at the crossing of the Red Sea. And so in that scene in the Red Sea and here, we see that God is the one who engages in the fighting and the warfare. And however we process that, what's clear is that the people do not do it. The people are not the ones picking up arms and going out to fight. Instead, what happens, of course, this is a very famous scene, is they rise up early in the morning. Jehoshaphat goes out and sends the priests and the singers out in front, and they're singing and praising on the way to the battle, and they don't actually have to fight this battle because God causes a confusion, and they end up killing each other and deserting the camp and leaving, so that the people do not actually have to engage in this fighting. And this line that Jehoshaphat proclaims in verse 20, "Believe in the Lord your God and you will be established, believe his prophets," echoes Isaiah 7 verse 9, which many people believe is the key verse in Isaiah. If you do not believe at all, you will not stand. If you believe, you will be established. And so that this key verse in Isaiah becomes a key verse in Chronicles. And this verse proclaims here dependence on God in the midst of political, military issues, as opposed to picking up arms and fighting and trying to win the day. So we could spend more time talking about the issue of God fighting the battles, but what I want to stress here is that the people do not fight. And repeatedly throughout Chronicles, what we see is that the people of Israel and the kings are allowed to fight defensive battles, but they are never allowed to fight offensive battles, except for David. He's the one exception. All of the other kings, all of the other righteous kings, do not fight offensive battles. And that is in direct contrast to what we get in the book of Kings. In the book of Kings, a sign that God is on your side is that you are victorious militarily. Not so in Chronicles. In Chronicles, offensive attacks are rejected. And righteous kings do not engage in them. I think that for brethren in particular, Anabaptists, that's a particularly powerful statement. And we would do well to think about books like Chronicles that illustrate this point of view in contrast to the stories we typically think about in Kings. The final example, then, I want to focus on Hezekiah and what happens in 2 Chronicles 30. In 2 Chronicles 30, we see a Passover celebration, and this is a story that is unique to Chronicles. It is not found in the book of Kings. It's not found elsewhere. In this story, Hezekiah decides that they're going to have a Passover that's going to be kept, and he again gathers together, this is verse 2, the officials and all the assembly. So again, we see this expansive notion of leadership. Hezekiah is not making this decision alone. He sends letters then, this group sends letters out to the people in the north, to Ephraim and Manasseh and the other tribes who have just been devastated by the Assyrians. Hezekiah would have every right to go into that territory and try to take it back and to expand the kingdom, but he chooses not to do that. Instead, he sends letters of invitation inviting these people to worship with the Judahites in Jerusalem to celebrate Passover. The text then is very explicit. Three times it says that the Passover was celebrated in the second month. It does not try to hide the fact that this is in the wrong month. According to the law, the Passover is supposed to be celebrated in the first month. But three times the text tells us, no, this was done in the second month. Oh, it was done in the second month? Hey, guess what? It was done in the second month, just in case you missed it. So the people are choosing to celebrate this Passover celebration at the wrong time. If they're going to follow the letter of the law, they should wait 11 months. They don't do that. They decide to celebrate it 1 month after when they should. So they're celebrating it at the wrong time, which would be in violation of the Torah. Then going on, they invite all of these northerners down, and only a few of them in verse 11 actually come. But nonetheless, they are invited, a few of them do come, and in verse 12, it says, "The hand of God was also on Judah to give them one heart to do what the king and the officials commanded by the word of the Lord." Here we see this one heart language. The people are brought into unity by an act of God. And we see a similar thing in Acts, where the people there are gathered in one accord, right, on the day of Pentecost. And so there's the sense in which this unity is particularly important for the people to function and to exist in this state. So we see a parallel there between the attitudes of the people and in Chronicles and what we see happening in the book of Acts. As the story then unfolds, the northerners come down and they decide to celebrate this festival, again, in the wrong month. The priests and the Levites, it says in verse 15, were ashamed, and they sanctified themselves and brought burnt offerings into the house of the Lord. They took their accustomed posts according to the law of Moses, the man of God. And, of course, the law of Moses doesn't have any stipulations about this. This is something that David puts together according to Chronicles. But it is consistent with the kinds of things that Moses would have prescribed for the tabernacle. But here we have a very different saying. So it's trying to claim Mosaic authority, the authority of Moses, for something that is implicit in the biblical text in the Pentateuch, but is not explicit. So we have a larger notion of what it means to be in continuity with the tradition. Even though the text doesn't say it, it's still valid and still linked to that tradition by inference or implication. Okay, so you can see hints in the text of this, but nothing explicit. Then the priest dashed the blood that was received from the hands of the Levites. We often think of the Levites as the assistants to the priests and who sort of just hand the priests stuff. Well, this is not exactly the case. In verse 17, there were many in the assembly who had not sanctified themselves. Therefore, the Levites had to slaughter the Passover lamb for everyone who was not clean to make it holy to the Lord. According to the law, it's the person themselves who are offering the animal who are supposed to kill the animal. They're supposed to put their hands on it and slit the animal's throat. The Levites and the priests are there to sort of do the rest of it, but the individual is actually the person who kills it. It says in this text that there were so many who were not prepared to do this that the Levites had to step in and do it anyway. So now we have the wrong people doing the wrong procedure at the wrong time. I just want to be clear about this. We have a lot of things that are not exactly following the law here in this passage. "For a multitude of people had not cleansed themselves, yet they ate the Passover otherwise than as prescribed." According to the law, these people were not clean, therefore they should not have eaten. Well, they ate anyway. in direct violation of the written law.
Violation upon violation.
Upon violation. And the text, instead of hiding this and trying to explain it, almost seems to celebrate and revel in it. As this then moves, Hezekiah prayed for them, saying, and this is a powerful prayer, very simple but powerful prayer, "The good Lord pardon all who set their hearts to seek God, the Lord, the God of their ancestors, even though not in accordance with the sanctuary's rules of cleanness." So we have Hezekiah calling upon the good Lord, and this is the only place in the entire Old Testament where in Hebrew the word good is used as an attributive adjective for Lord. So the statement God is good, the Lord is good, shows up everywhere. But the actual phrase "the good Lord" only shows up here in Hebrew. It only shows up here. And I think that's a powerful statement about God's character and the appeal to God's goodness that Hezekiah is making. So Hezekiah prays for this pardoning. They've done it wrong. They know they've done it wrong, and they're being asked for forgiveness. And why? On all those who set their hearts to seek God. We mentioned in the first podcast that this was a dominant theme throughout the book. Here we see it at a key moment. The key to this is their hearts were in the right place. The condition of the heart trumps following the letter of the law. Their hearts were in the right place. They were seeking God. And that is what matters. Not whether the right person was in the right place at the right time doing the right thing. This is what's more important. And of course, God's response is to zap them. No, that's not God's response. I think some people might expect that's what God's response would be, or that God would send a prophet to say, "Hey, y'all, stop. We need to do this correctly." No, God heals the people. He heard Hezekiah and heals the people. And then the response of this is such exuberant joy that the people decide to celebrate the festival another 7 days. So the law requires a celebration of 7 days. They go 14. They're just so excited that things are going so well, and there's such a spirit of restoration here at this moment. So we have people who should be out being included. We have rules that are not being followed. We have this very simple but powerful theological prayer on the part of Hezekiah, and God's response is to heal and to honor all of this in the condition of the people's hearts, as opposed to the letter of the law that had been laid down. I think this is a theologically provocative text, and one that we would do very well to pay attention to. All of us have key texts, texts that serve as lenses through which we read other texts, the Sermon on the Mount or whatever. For me, this is one of those texts. 2 Chronicles 30 has become a dominant text for me in thinking theologically about not just Chronicles or the Old Testament, but the whole Bible and what we're supposed to gain from it. Looking back again into this text in 2 Chronicles 30, we see a very clear affirmation of this desire to pursue God and to go beyond what the law has called for, and to get at the heart of the law rather than the letter of the law, even when the spirit, the condition of the heart, the understanding, seems to be in conflict with what the law actually says. And when I've taught this text in the past, I've often at this point said something like, if Jesus were here and he was in the midst of this celebration, what would he do? Would Jesus call out and say, no, we need to follow the law, we need to wait 11 months, we need to get the Levites back where they're supposed to be, we need to wait until these people are all cleansed? Would he be the one calling out and saying, you know, this isn't quite right? Or would he be the one in the amen corner saying, that's right, keep going, God approves of this? Yes, this is the right thing to be doing. Which one would it be? Which Jesus would show up? The Jesus who would correct this in 2 Chronicles 30, or the Jesus who would be jumping up and down and celebrating because people are being healed and restored? I think it's the latter. I think that's the Jesus we see in the Gospels. And I think Jesus would stand in celebration with the people for the extra 7 days, that God had smiled upon them and that their hearts were definitely trying to seek the Lord. So I find this to be, again, just a key moment in the text. And as you unpack the rest of the story in Chronicles, quickly after Hezekiah, things start to fall apart pretty fast. And the movement towards the end is one that is not nearly as dismal as the one in Kings, but it's still negative, and yet there's still hope for restoration. So as the book moves to its conclusion, I think this is the high point. It's in Chronicles 30. And as the people then begin to move away from that, we see the need for continued restoration, continued reform. And when the dust settles and the people have returned from their exile, they try to move back to the temple and a state of worship that is authentic. And I think that the same call goes out for us today, that we should be thinking about what it means to worship God in ways that are authentic to our past and our heritage, while at the same time recognizing that there is much opportunity and many ways to think about what it means to be faithful. For Hezekiah certainly is faithful, but not in the ways you might expect.
Fabulous, Steve. Your energy and excitement around Chronicles is really evident, and you're helping the rest of us to gain some of that too. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Anton.
Church of the Brethren webcasts are made possible through the collaborative efforts of all of the Church of the Brethren agencies and are produced by Bethany Theological Seminary. For more information about these webcasts, please visit us on the web at www.cobwebcast.bethanyseminary.edu. Thank you for joining us for the Church of the Brethren webcast series.